Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Wichita County versus Hart and Williams.
May it please the court, Ms. Ann Clark Snell will present arguments for petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes to rebuttal.
May it please the court. With me today is co-counsel Valerie Kirk, and also from Wichita County, Judge Mick Gibson, and Commissioner White, and Sheriff Callahan.
You need to speak louder.
From Wichita County, we also have our county judge, Judge Gibson, the sheriff, Sheriff Callahan, and Commissioner White. Wichita County was defendant in this whistleblower case. Alan Hart and Ernie Williams, two former deputies of the sheriff, were plaintiffs, and they are the respondents and the conditional petitioners in this proceeding. We come before you to present significant unresolved legal issues under the Whistleblower Act. This important statute has often been interpreted as though it existed in a vacuum rather than as a part of a body of law. We believe that the guidance of other law existing at the time of the Act passage and developed in this court to the present are essential aids to understanding and implementing the Whistleblower Act. The facts are not addressed in our prepared remarks, but they are vigorously contested, as our brief certainly shows. Our points of error are venue, good faith, whether the conduct of the officers was reasonable, mental anguish, and malice. With regard to venue, the Whistleblower Act was passed in 1983 by the same session of the legislature that enacted a well-publicized and long-awaited revision of the venue statute. Commentators and practitioners alike, for many years, had criticized the confused and complex state of venue law in Texas. Plaintiffs and defendants' bars were cooperating in 1983 on this effort, but they reached an impasse. Then Chief Justice Pope came in and helped them reach a resolution, which they did. Consequently, the venue statute was completely reorganized in 1983. Subchapter A was the general venue provision, subchapter B was the mandatory exceptions to the general provision, and subchapter C was the permissive exceptions to the general venue statute. The legislature adopted some decisional venue law and rejected others. Venue exceptions contained in outside statutes, such as the Whistleblower Act, were incorporated into the revised general statute through provisions in subchapter B if they were mandatory and a provision in subchapter C if they were permissive. The legislature enacted the Whistleblower Act and the revised general venue statute within 2 days of each other in 1983. Both became effective September 1, 1983. Since 1846, the mandatory county venue statute has provided that an action against a county shall be brought in that county.
Is there any instance where a county can be sued outside of its borders?
I'm not aware of any, Justice Spector. It may be that, for instance, in the situation where you have, let's say, a judicial review of an administrative proceeding, and the statute makes it very clear that the only courts that can hear such matters are specifically specified. In that instance, a county might have to participate in a proceeding there. It might be brought into it. But I'm not aware of any situation in which a county may be sued outside of its county. The venue provision of the Whistleblower Act, adopted 2 days after the venue statute, provided a public employee may bring suit in the district court of the county in which he resides or in the district court of Travis County. The venue provision of the Whistleblower Act, as amended this year, provides a public employee of a state governmental entity may sue in the district court of the county in which the cause of action arises or in the District Court of Travis County. And a public employee of a local government may sue in a district court of the county in which the cause of action arises or in a district court of any county in the same geographic area that has established a council of government. The legislature revised the venue law in 1983, demonstrating its intent that that shall is to indicate mandatory and may is to indicate permissive, and they were consistent in that. And yet, the legislature has always, to this day, used may in the Whistleblower Act's venue provision. When construing a statute, the place to start, of course, is with the words of the statute itself. No language in the Whistleblower Act indicates that its venue provision is to be read as mandatory. Furthermore, statutes passed by the same legislature are presumed to have been enacted with complete knowledge of existing law and with reference to the other statute. This rule applies with particular force when statutes are passed at the very same session of the legislature. In fact, such statutory provisions are construed as if they were one act. When more than one venue provision is or one venue site is authorized, this court has held, and others have followed it, that determining proper venue requires classification of the venue provision as mandatory or permissive. Recognizing that venue is an important concern in litigation while assisting plaintiffs and defendants bars in reaching a court in 1983 on venue, Chief Justice Pope offered to obtain and did obtain a provision, lessening the burden on movements who are seeking to transfer venue because they're unable to get an impartial trial. In 1983, the Rules of Civil Procedure, specifically Rules 257 to 259, were revised in order to make that easier to do. And one may obtain a transfer if you cannot reach it, have an impartial trial in the venue where you are located by substantiating your motion with the affidavits of three credible citizens of that county.
An effort was made in the past session of the legislature to try to get them to clarify this, and they refused. What's the effect of that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that whatever efforts were made with the legislature this time to clarify issues, I'm not really just sure exactly what they were. I know that the legislature did take out punitive damages, did make some changes with regard to some of the provisions of the Act. I'm not sure how much clearer it is.
Didn't your law firm participate in asking for changes in the statute or not?
No, Your Honor. I never represented, and no one from my law firm did, anybody seeking changes. I was asked by various people my opinion about things, and I did testify for myself, but I was not in any way advocating for any particular client. I wasn't a lobbyist or anything. I merely, because of having worked on this venue article that was published in the Texas Tech Law Review, I was asked to come and talk about it in general. And under the venue statute itself, the court on motion is required in mandatory terms. It shall transfer an action if an impartial trial cannot be had in the county in which the action is pending. Prejudicial forums were therefore discussed in 1983. At the same time that the Whistleblower Act was passed, the legislature expressed no intent to create a safe harbor provision in the whistleblower venue provision in 1983, and it didn't in 1995, insofar as I can tell. Regarding mandatory venue provisions in the venue statute and permissive venue provisions in other statutes, this court has stated, a permissive venue provision in a statute applicable to actions of a particular kind must always yield to the mandatory provision of the venue statute. Moreover, this court has also held that uncertainty regarding venue provisions is to be resolved in favor of the defendant. Finally, plaintiffs and defendants bars, along with Chief Justice Pope and the legislature in this instance, all agreed that erroneous venue determinations require reversal and remanding of the case for a new trial.
So all your other points of error would be mooted if we agree with you on this point?
No, Your Honor, I don't think they're mooted. I believe that if we retry this case, we also need to have the jury have an instruction that is appropriate on good faith.
Well, anything we might say would be dicta, wouldn't it?
I think you could rule on all the points of error that have been raised, Your Honor. I know that there are doctrines under which the court would say that it should decide the first issue or the issue that resolves the case, and that would be it. We would get a new trial. But much like the case that was decided recently, the Hines case, in which a new trial was granted, in that situation, the court, while not answering all the questions, did provide an instruction so that the jury in the new trial would be properly instructed regarding the causation requirements of the statute. We think we have similar concerns about other issues that would be really rather pointless, or at least it would be a waste of time and resources to go down and have to come up again if the same kind of errors that we have pointed to in this proceeding were perpetuated in a future proceeding.
But writing on non-dispositive points of error would be a purely advisory opinion, wouldn't it?
Your Honor, I think it would be any of these issues that we've raised would make the decision with regard to that particular issue. I think that the case could be reversed and remanded on the good faith issue alone, or on the standard to apply to a law enforcement official regarding whether his conduct is reasonable. Any one of those points that the court might decide to render a decision on would have the same result as the venue provision would have in terms of subsequent litigation in this case. I don't think it would be moot, Your Honor. It might not be necessary in order for the court to exercise its jurisdiction and make a decision that would relieve this court of further duty. I think it would be certainly appropriate, and I think that it has been done in other cases, to decide more than one issue.
Turning then to the good faith issue, does, in your view, any element of malice or bad faith on their motive taint a whistleblower?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that it does. The last report, the Waco Court of Appeals, has stated that if the whistleblower actually reports a violation of law, then whatever his venal intent might be is irrelevant. I think that's a bad policy decision, and I would not agree with that, Your Honor. It depends on the type of violation. That's another problem with the statute. The statute really does not directly address what whistleblowing is. Whistleblowing is not reporting that you saw somebody going 65 in a 55-mile zone, but that is a violation of law. Whistleblowing is when a public employee puts his job on the line in order to protect the public's interest. So the Act still has many problems, as Justice Heck mentioned. It's very difficult.
Why should the employee's venality or whatever bad motive he's got take away from the fact that the person he's reporting is a felon?
Well, that's one of the things we're talking about.
Well, I'm asking you, why is that? Why should he not receive the benefits of the statute, whether he hates the guy or loves the guy?
If it's a felony, again, I was trying to sort of to say, I think this is a complicated question. It would depend to me on the nature of the violation being reported. Let's say you reported a felony, and what you said was you thought somebody was stealing some money out of the cash drawer, and you actually saw something that appeared to you to be that kind of conduct. But in fact, you could have easily inquired and found that the person was removing the money for some legitimate purpose, and it was not in any way a theft. That's the kind of question that I think that some sort of standard that at least says, let's look at both of these issues. Did you have reasonable cause to believe there had been a violation of law, and were you acting in a proper motive? I think that that's always been an issue, and we've had to deal with that over and over again in these kinds of public law questions.
So the employee, in your view, has to have a pure heart. If he's doing it because he's always been mad at this guy and and never going to change. Even if the guy is stealing money out of the till, he's not going to get the benefits of the statute.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know whether that employee's conduct should be protected. I think that's my problem. You see around us in this country today so much vindictive conduct, so much conduct that I think it's very bad public policy to condone or to encourage or protect, but that doesn't mean that the felon should not be punished for his felony. And that, for the general society, is enough. That's what our criminal law is about. It's not somebody having a civil remedy and being able to obtain damages. It's about protecting the public interest. So I think it's a complicated balance here, Your Honor, and we do think that the motive of the reporter should be considered.
But if the employee comes in, what he needs to say is that it breaks his heart to have to do this, and he loves the person to pieces, but the truth of the matter is he saw him take money out of the till.
So that sort of self-serving statement does have to be taken at face value, Your Honor.
But you'd certainly want to try to bolster that view if you were the employee.
Yes, Your Honor, certainly would.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. John Culler will present argument for the respondent.
Let me just ask the same question. Do you know of any instance where a county can be sued outside of the courthouse?
Besides the Whistleblower Act and the amendments that have just been passed, none come to mind immediately other than perhaps the ones where the state would be involved and there might be some mandatory or some other statute that says that they can be sued in Travis County or somewhere else. But I think that in that respect, Justice Spector, what we've got to keep in mind, as this court said in, I think it was in Polaris just recently, venue is a creature of the legislature, and counties and their mandatory venue provision, it exists solely because the legislature said that they could have the mandatory venue provision. That can be taken away. It's not something that is sacrosanct. It's not something that is unamendable. It's not something that is constitutional in nature. And so a county can be sued outside its borders anytime the legislature says that it may be sued outside of its borders. And of course, the question in this case is to determine the legislative intent. When you look at the Whistleblower Act, which was clearly an act set up to go beyond the parameters of employment at will, which was set up to provide a place for people who have acted to inform on someone who has violated the law, to keep them from being terminated. When you look at that and realize that the legislature was creating a new cause of action, it's clear that within the four corners of this act, the legislature said that counties could be sued outside their boundaries.
Is there any other post-1983 examples of a venue where the word may is used for a mandatory venue provision?
Your Honor, not that I'm aware of. But what I would point out about the 1983 amendments, Ms. Snell suggests that this was all done at the same time and therefore because the general venue statute, Chapter 15 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, says that if the word may is used, then it's going to be permissive, and if the word shall is used, it's mandatory. What we've got to keep in mind, as the Court of Appeals pointed out in its opinion, in determining that the venue provision in the Whistleblower Act was mandatory, is that when Justice Pope and the others came up with the agreement, they rejected the notion of putting in Chapter 15 the idea that a lawsuit could be possible and permissible in the county of the plaintiff's residence. That was rejected. And the compromise that came about and that was implemented in Chapter 15 said that it can be in the county of the defendant's residence or in the county where a part of the cause of action accrued. They rejected this idea of allowing a plaintiff to put it in his home residence. But they did use that. They did come in the Whistleblower Act in the same session and say that a whistleblower may put this cause of action within the boundaries of his home county.
It's permissive.
No, it's not permissive. As Justice Gonzalez in Grounds versus Toler, What that opinion said was, you look at it, and it says the decision as to whether or not to pursue litigation, that that's permissive, but the site of the trial is mandatory. This is an exclusively statutory cause of action, just as in Grounds versus Toler. And just as in Grounds versus Toler, you know, we have got to comply with all aspects of it. If the legislature had said a cause of action shall be brought, well, that puts on the burden of every person who's blown the whistle and been retaliated against of having to, I mean, shall being mandatory, they shall file the suit. Well, that's not what may meant in this case. What may means, just as the justice pointed out in Grounds versus Toler, it's a decision as to whether or not to bring the lawsuit, but if the lawsuit is brought, it must be brought either in the county of the plaintiff's residence or in Travis County. That's why we think that it's properly characterized as jurisdictional, although we don't have any problem with the Court of Appeals' opinion saying it's mandatory. I just think that it doesn't fit under Mingus and Grounds versus Toler and these other Supreme Court cases that say that an exclusively statutory cause of action has to be complied with exclusively. And even though the word may is used in terms of where the lawsuit can be filed, it is still jurisdictional and it's mandatory that it be filed in one of those two locations. The county would have you perpetuate what they've asked for, an anomaly since day one for the Whistleblower Act. The Whistleblower Act defined counties as being subject to the whole Act. Every aspect of the Whistleblowers Act said that every governmental entity in the state, including counties, is going to be subject to the provisions of the Whistleblower Act. Yet, they want this anomaly so that county employees are required to litigate only within the boundaries of the county, while people who are in a school district, they've got the choice of doing it in their home county under the old Act or in Travis County or under the new Act in the county where the cause of action accrued.
Can an action be jurisdictional in more counties than venue is proper?
I think that it can. I think that jurisdiction in this case, where you have an exclusively statutory cause of action, where the legislature has said these are the district courts that are going to have jurisdiction or potential jurisdiction over this cause, that can certainly happen. Again, jurisdiction can be conferred by the legislature, so I think that it can happen, and I think that that's exactly what has happened with the 1995 amendments, where the legislature has now said we're going to allow these causes of action to be tried either in the county where they accrued or in one of the council of government counties. So the county, Wichita County, doesn't want you to allow that to happen, even though that's clearly the intent of the legislature from this last session. And I think that to go beyond and to say that a county, even though everything within the Act says that the county is subject to the Act, that everything applies to it except for that venue provision, and there we get trumped by Chapter 15 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, creates a huge anomaly, an anomaly that was not ever envisioned or approved of by the legislature. In looking at it, the legislature, at the 95 amendments, the same sentence construction is used. It says a public employee may sue. That's what it said under the Act that we sued under, 6252-16A. That's what it said in the codification in 1993. That's what it says in the 95 amendments. So the mere fact that the word may is used is not dispositive in this case. That's the easy way out. That was certainly the argument that was made in Grounds versus Toler back in 1986, and this court rejected it. This court said that that's not the way we're going to look at it. We're going to look at it and take note that the statute says that these are the locations where the case can be tried. Our position is that whether it's mandatory or whether it's jurisdictional, the intent of the legislature to put the counties to trial outside their boundaries is something which is very evident from the face of the statute. And so even though this question of venue is new for this court, it's a case of first impression, it's very clear that irrespective of mandatory or jurisdictional, that we were allowed to try this case in Travis County, and we would ask the court to confirm that. With respect to the good faith issues, the good faith language of the Whistleblower Act has been the same since 1983. It was the same in 1991. It was left the same after the Waco court in Laster came out and said, we're going to look at this in terms of whether or not the individual who reported the violation of law was acting in good faith, whether they believed that a violation of law was going to occur. The legislature left that language the same in 91. More importantly, in 1993, when they codified it, with no substantive changes supposedly to have been taken, they codified it and used the same exact good faith language. And then this year, after Laster, after the Leach case, after the Green case, after our case, which came out in October of 94, they left the language the same again. So in every instance, it appears to us, and we would suggest to this court, that the legislature has expressed its intent to acquiesce to the interpretations that have been given of good faith by the legislature, or by the courts, excuse me.
Could you touch on the county's contention that the county has no liability for the sheriff's action?
Well, that would be to suggest that, that the sheriff was not part of the county. And as we pointed out in our brief, under the Texas Tort Claims Act, that argument has been rejected, and there's absolutely no reason not to do that here. I don't know if I was being overly cute or what in a footnote where I said in its most organic sense, the county is the people who reside within that county. And so everyone within that county, their argument is the commissioner's court is the only one who can appropriate it. Well, every elected official...
Is that the way your judgment is only to be paid by commissioner's court?
It will require, I think it's Chapter 81 of the Local Government Code says that if a judgment against the county becomes final, that you cannot levy execution against it, that you must present it to the commissioner's court and ask the commissioner's court to pay it as you would any other claim. If they fail to do that, then there are judicial remedies that may be pursued, but it's clearly going to take an act of the commissioner's court or a court forcing a commissioner's court to act to pay this judgment that has been rendered against the county by virtue of the actions of a countywide elected official. And I hope that responded.
Back on good faith, how can it be that an employee is protected just because he believes really sincerely that this is a violation of the law when it just plain isn't?
Judge, the focus of this act, they didn't say we're going to give protection from some unknown source for employees who blow the whistle. They said we're going to protect people who in good faith report violations of law from being suspended, from being terminated, or otherwise from being discriminated against in some way. Now, the focus, we wouldn't be here today if my clients had been mistaken and the sheriff had said, fellas, if you had the facts, you wouldn't have done this. I'm not going to fire you. But the facts in this case are, and it's appended to all the briefs we put in, they wrote that the reason my clients were terminated was because they initiated an investigation against the sheriff. We've got a smoking gun, that's why it was done. Now, to answer the question here about why they should be protected, here's the question. The county wants to say, look here, you have got to show that it was an actual violation of law. Well, who makes that determination is the biggest problem that's ever going to exist in that type of analysis. Is it made by the district attorney, who may be and was in this case a political ally and crony of the person who had the whistle blown on it? Is it going to be made by a grand jury, which is under that district attorney's auspices? Is it going to be by a jury who's going to hear not only defenses raised and other things which may legally excuse the behavior, But they're going to hear all manner of facts which the whistleblower didn't have. So the focus for the whistleblower has got to be, did he act as our court instructed the jury? They said, he said that good faith means honesty in fact and conduct concerned. A report of a violation of law may be in good faith, even though it is incorrect, as long as that belief is not unreasonable. Now, within that definition, the county could come in and had the room and did come in and say it was unreasonable. Of course it was unreasonable. Of course it was unreasonable for these two deputies to think that this was a violation of law. They should have known something else. And in spite of that, having heard all the evidence, the jury in our case rejected that argument and said, we're going to look at what did these people believe at the time they did it. Did they believe that a violation of law occurred when they reported it, and were they then retaliated against?
One of the amicus suggests that the standard ought to be probable cause. Why isn't that a good standard?
Who makes that determination? Do we have two trials within one trial, our civil trial, where we prove probable cause, or it's going to depend in so many instances on...
Why is it any more of a burden to prove that than it is to prove good faith? You're going to have to prove something.
Yes, sir. And the point of the matter is that they are allowed, under the definition that was used, when they say that as long as the belief was not unreasonable, or that the belief was reasonable, is what those two negatives tell us. Not unreasonable would be that the belief must be reasonable. And so they can argue the probable cause. They've got much more latitude here than otherwise. But what you're talking about is putting a burden on employees of government that they be correct, that they not make a mistake here and run the risk, even though they believe, honestly believe, that a violation of laws went on, they're going to say...
But isn't it pretty important to be correct if you're going to charge a superior, particularly an elected official, with a crime?
I think clearly it is important to be correct. But what's more important, according to what the legislature told us, it's more important that that superior officer not retaliate for you having made that report.
Shouldn't we have a presumption that if there has been a violation of the law, that the whistleblower was in good faith, and that the fact issue on good faith only arises where the accuser was incorrect? Wouldn't that be the best way to slice this?
Well, it could be, and I haven't really thought that through, Justice Warren. I'm not sure I'm prepared to answer that. We have a presumption within the Whistleblower Act that if the retaliation occurs within 90 days, that it was... they were connected, that the act of retaliation was caused by the act of blowing the whistle. That's a rebuttal.
What about the issue of good faith, whether the whistleblower, if the whistleblower was accurate and there was a violation of law, that we presume good faith, and so we only get into a fact issue on what constitutes good faith, where the whistleblower was incorrect and if there was no violation.
What I fear in an analysis along those lines is that we're going to end up with two types of whistleblowers. Those who are in jurisdictions where the district attorney or others are going to truly examine the facts and make a real-life, honest-to-goodness determination based on what the facts are about whether a crime occurred, or if we're in a jurisdiction like Wichita County where they're not going to make that determination because the district attorney is good friends with the sheriff, and for political purposes, they're not going to do that. So I would be concerned that in going to and saying if a crime truly existed, that's the problem.
Then you're just left with the fact issue. If the presumption only would apply where there has been a determination of
I think that would be a good presumption to put into place and would make it easier. I think, though, that as far as that fact issue goes and the burden of trial, if you have had a determination made, you don't need that presumption.
Would you agree that the instruction that was actually given when it's all boiled down equals or equates to reasonableness, a reasonable standard, and not a true good faith standard?
Well, in terms of whether or not it was an actual violation of law, I agree that the instruction that was given, and it was not my instruction, it was a compromise instruction at trial, the judge added the words, as long as that belief was not unreasonable. And so it does get down to what was reasonable, and it gives the defendant in whistleblower cases great latitude to argue. And that's what trial lawyers ought to want to have, is the ability to argue that.
What was the instruction you asked for?
I think mine stopped with good faith means honesty in fact and conduct concern. A report of a violation of law may be in good faith even though it is incorrect, period. And the court went on to say, as long as the belief is not unreasonable. So our trial court went to great lengths to give the county what they wanted to be able to argue, and they did argue it, and the jury didn't buy their arguments about what these guys should have believed, would have believed, and could have believed.
Counsel, in your remaining time, would you address the issue of meta language? The evidence appears to be rather slim to justify meta language damages. Would you give us your best?
My best shot on that?
Your best shot in justifying the meta language past and future.
Yes, sir. Your Honor, on June 15th, this court came out with Parkway Company versus Woodruff. And what the court said was that an award of mental anguish will survive a legal sufficiency challenge when the plaintiffs have introduced direct evidence of the nature, duration, and severity of their mental anguish, thus establishing a substantial disruption in the plaintiff's daily routine. When you look through at the public humiliation, which we have cited and indicated to the court, when you look through at the disruption and these guys' lives, the fact that one of them is sitting here having to commute from Wichita Falls to Bryan College Station to work, when you look at what they testified to in total, we have direct evidence under Parkway Company versus Woodruff. There was additional testimony from another attorney in Wichita County who said that he'd gotten crossways with the county and that he had to practice law in Tarrant County for 10 years. So we not only had the direct evidence of my clients, but we had the direct evidence from an attorney in Wichita County who said that it does disrupt your life. It does, validated what my clients were saying and indicated that when you cross the powers to be in Wichita County, your life can be rather miserable. And so I'm out of time, but I think that all of those references to public humiliation for direct evidence, we complied with standards you set out in Parkland, and we would ask the court to affirm on all issues. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Respondents state that with regard to the county, the legislature can enact a change with regard to venue. We agree with that. The question, though, before this court is whether the legislature has repealed the mandatory venue provision with regard to counties as it applies in the whistleblower situation. We had here pointed to some sort of anomaly as though it were created in 1983. The different treatment of counties under venue law is nearly 150 years old. Every plaintiff in any cause of action has had to sue them in the county. This is not an anomaly created under the Whistleblower Act. This is the way the counties have been treated for nearly 150 years. And it arises out of a historical point of view that the county is not a municipal corporation that exists for the convenience of its citizens, but that it is, in fact, the state government's presence in a local geographical area. It doesn't, for instance, have the ability to expand its borders, the ability to annex territory, and so on. It has only the power specifically granted to it by the state. It is quite different from other powers or other kinds of local powers that have a little piece of power from the government which they may exercise as they wish, as with the city, except with regard to the powers that are taken away from it by the legislature by affirmative action. And of course, we would contend with regard to the jurisdictional arguments that the Whistleblower Act is really not exclusively a statutory cause of action. There have been ways to sue governmental entities acting outside the scope of their authority for many years. The mandamus action is not an action against the state or any government, and yet it does allow one to sue the government to make it do what it should, to make it do what the law requires it to do. Similarly, one may sue under such cases as Cobb versus Harrington, a very old case, probably over 50 years old. I think it was in the 40s. You may sue when a trespass has occurred by the government, when some other wrongful act has occurred, where the government is acting outside the scope of this authority or without authorization by statute. So we don't really have any unique situation here. And we would contend, Your Honor, that even if it were jurisdictional, that does not answer the venue question. So Travis County has jurisdiction, as does the county in which these plaintiffs resided. That was Wichita County. The venue question is still open. There's mandatory venue in Wichita County. We would therefore contend that regardless of whether this provision is jurisdictional, Wichita County had jurisdiction and venue was mandatory in that site. With regard to whether any of these...
If that was so, why would the legislation so recently as a few years ago say that under the whistleblower statute plaintiffs may sue in their own county or in Travis County?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand the question.
The Whistleblower Act says very clearly that a plaintiff may bring a lawsuit in the county where they reside or in Travis County.
Right.
So if this body of law is as old as you say it is, you know, why would the legislature say otherwise so recently as this past few years?
Well, Your Honor, the way I read that provision is, and there have been many instances in which I've had whistleblower cases, that the county would prefer that the case were not tried in that county. It creates a whole lot of bad publicity. It might have been a situation which was very divisive in the community. Then the litigants could agree to try the case not under the mandatory venue provision that's applicable to counties, which may be waived, but in the county where the particular individual resided. I've had that happen also with regard to going ahead and trying it in Travis County. These situations are situations in which people for various reasons may want to decide to try the case in a county that is convenient and appropriate for their choices. I see no reason, Your Honor, and nothing from the legislature that would indicate that might not be done in this instance. It would seem to me that it would be reasonable and simple and consistent with most venue law that exists in the state. Good faith in the Whistleblower Act is certainly not resolved. There's been no decision by any court of last resort regarding by this court, which is the court of last resort on this issue, with regard to good faith in the Whistleblower
Act. What do the federal courts do?
I beg your pardon?
What do the federal courts do?
On good faith? On good faith, Your Honor, I think that it's been very interesting recently that this court has been looking at that, and in the city of Lancaster they certainly did. Also, I really felt that Hines carefully looked at that. What they do in good faith and reasonability, which I think are very closely connected, is they look at what a reasonable law enforcement officer, for instance, in the same or similar circumstances would have done, and if they could have done what was done, and it would have been reasonable for any other officer in that situation, it's going to essentially be privileged as being done in good faith. However, there is always the possibility of showing in any of these instances that one is acting outside the scope of their authority or for purposes that are not purposes that are consistent with their duties and to find that they are acting in bad faith.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument and the third call. The court will take another brief recess.
Your Honor,